Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. It's Chef Tom Douglas.
And Jerry Roturo, the chef in hat.
And Katie O.
We are here once again for a two-hour spell. Thank you for joining us. I'm chef owner of several of Seattle's fine establishments, including the Hot Stove Society, where we do our show from every week. If you want tickets, although we have no audience today, if you do want tickets for our live shows, please just go to hotstovesociety.com and join us. Be part of the party.
That's right. You're going to have a lot of fun if you are.
Exactly. Chef, you're 2 weeks back now from Peru.
That's
have
correct.
Have you readjusted?
It's actually 1 week and a half, but
okay.
That's okay.
Okay.
I'm not counting. But yes, I have been readjusting and working very, very hard. As you know, going on vacation is a little task, and coming back is a bigger task.
Yeah, exactly. Katie O's here.
Yep, sure am.
Are you on the go this week, Katie?
I am not on the go. I'm on the go as in I'm here with you right now and not doing other things. But
all right.
Excited for the show ahead.
We have many questions from our listeners, including a brisket question, which is going to be interesting since I'm a – I always get this wrong. Am I a Gentile?
Yes. Yeah, you're yes, not right, a Jew.
Okay. So, but Gentiles don't necessarily know how to do brisket outside of smoking it. Right? So I'm looking forward to your answers on how to make brisket. And maybe, well, you don't know. Sarah doesn't know. We're going to host Easter brunch using the same ingredient in every course. I hope it's hollandaise sauce, Katie. It's up to you. It's your house.
Okay.
And, of course, we're going to do our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia at the end of the show, so you have to wait 2 full hours for that. It's already counting down.
But first, can we touch a little bit on the Bell of Notre Dame being silenced for a few months or a few years, maybe?
Oh, I would guess it's a few years.
Yes.
Yeah,
and we think
ahead.
It will be a few years. It's a sad picture to see that monumental, iconic building burning so heavily. Mm-hmm. It was those pictures were those live feed that is incredible, by the way, that right away, 10 minutes into it, you can get live feed mm-hmm. from Paris all around the world about the cathedral, Notre Dame burning down. That was a pretty sad picture, and that that spire falling down was pretty sad news. But
I got to say, it never would have occurred to me that that spire was wood.
But it's actually wood and lead. It was lead. Huge, huge amount of lead. I don't remember how much, but that's one of the probably one of the reasons it also fell down in mm-hmm. the end. But mm-hmm. but anyway, the whole thing is a sad thing to see burned down. But at the same time, it gives us an opportunity. As we know in America, we always seize the moment to retrieve and make it even better. So I think, some great things are about to come out through. And on day two of that sad event, there's already $6 million poured into it from French company, and I'm sure plenty more to come. So
I saw this morning, and we're taping on a Tuesday morning here. I saw this morning that they had $600 million already.
$600 million
towards the rebuild. So good. Okay, Katie.
Let's do ordinary.
It's time for you.
Yeah, ordinary to extraordinary. This is where you take some ordinary dishes and you make them extraordinary. And this week we are taking some suggestions from our listeners. So the first one comes from Maria, and she says, "What are some good ways to prepare and cook pork chops? I haven't made them in a while. When I do, I have the tendency to overcook them. Thank you for your suggestion." So, an ordinary, maybe even dry, a little bit pork chop turned extraordinary. What do you got?
I think the first way to make it extraordinary is to buy a meat thermometer and use it. That would really be helpful on the pork chop because, yes, pork chop have a tendency to dry out because there's not much fat on the meat. There
right.
is no fat. So when you're grilling or sauteing your pork chop, the tendency of overcooking it is always part of most home cook. Just buy a meat thermometer, punch it next to the bone, and see what the temperature is on the inside. Once you've reached 135, just stop. Move the chop out of the pan. Let it sit. It's going to rest, and it's going to keep cooking to 140, and I think you'll have a wonderful pork chop.
And that's especially true on thin pork chops. You
correct.
Really want to get them a little bit underdone off the heat. So
correct.
Because of the hotness of your pan, mm-hmm. the heat of your pan, they'll continue to cook really
right.
quickly. So whereas a roast, you might say, like in a turkey or a prime rib, you might, once you let it rest, it might go up 5 or 8 degrees, maybe
right.
10 at the most. A pork chop might jump 20 or 25 degrees.
Correct.
Because it's so shallow,
right.
the meat thickness is so
right.
shallow. And, of course, the thicker the pork chop, the longer or the less it's going to go
right.
up in temperature. So that's
and on making it extraordinary, I'm a big fan of marinating my pork chop in olive oil, mustard, rosemary, you know, some nice herb basically that are in the garden right now, and then marinate that pork chop for a couple of hours on the counter, as in give it a nice, it soaks in really nicely that mustard, then remove that big thickness of mustard and then put your chop on the grill and then give it a nice grill on both sides, no flame, just nice grilling, and you'll have a wonderful pork chop.
And there's one last trick I would say is when you're looking at pork chops to buy, look to buy towards the shoulder end of the pig. And so if you're looking at the whole loin or if you're looking at the chop, you want to buy the chops that are at least a T-bone chop. Or not, you don't want just the loin because that's the leanest part and it's going to dry out the quickest. But you want to buy the shoulder almost where they get the country-style pork ribs from, all the way up to that shoulder blade chop is a much better chop than, I think, the center.
Absolutely.
And people so often want the center cut, right? And the good part about the center cut is it comes with the baby back rib bone attached, and it's good eaten. But up where it is, the darker meat, you know, you want the really the much pinker meat.
It's more tender.
It's more tender.
More
it's a little
flavorful.
Bit,
it's more utilized.
Well, it's more flavorful because it's a little bit fattier, and it is it's a much better pork chop experience. And I would suggest right now, you know, we're talking seasonal, green garlic is hitting the grocery store shelves. And it's certainly coming out of our farm right now. I'd have it in every one of our restaurants. And just a charred green garlic relish.
Absolutely.
Even if you char it in a cast iron pan, just get some caramelization on that, chop it up, and make a little green garlic relish. Would be so easy with
green garlic,
lemon juice, olive oil, salt.
Green garlic and rhubarb chutney. That would be delicious.
Tom is shivering with
I'm
disgust.
Shivering on that one. I don't like rhubarb in that way, personally. I'm not a big rhubarb fan, but
I think rhubarb.
I mean, I love it that it's our first sign of spring, but
One suggestion that was on here that we can't get to in this segment is from Lori, and she wants to know how to make extraordinary rice. And frankly, so do I. I think in hour two, we're going to discuss my foible in the kitchen, and I think that you two can help.
All right. Oh. That's going to be in the Baker's Corner spot because Brittany had an emergency today. Can't join us. But we're going to have Katie's Rice Rescue.
Thank you. 911.
911. On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Up next, do Americans hate artichokes? We're talking about how you pick, prep, and cook an artichoke delicious enough to change your mind. Hey, we're back in the kitchen at the Seattle Kitchen, that is, from the Hot Stove Society. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
And Katie, do you love artichokes?
I love them.
And we hear through Sarah, our producer, that Americans really don't care for artichokes much. And the only thing I can think of why that would be any different than any other vegetable is that they're kind of a pain in the patootie to get prepped up.
They are. They require a little bit of effort, but maybe I like that. I like a hard-to-get piece of food, and artichokes are that to a certain extent.
So I think I would agree with you, Tom. I think that is probably 90% of the reason why people don't usually buy them is because they probably just know how to throw them in a pot of water, boil them, and that's the end of that.
Well, I mean, you think about what people complain about in the kitchen. One is like the smell of cooking fish.
Yeah, of course.
Or the fish has got too many bones, right? Because they don't know how to trim it properly.
Well, I don't want to see a whole chicken.
You see these boneless, skinless chicken breasts, you know, where they take all the effort out of that chicken. Boneless, skinless white fish. I just think that we've become a little bit lazy when it comes to our food. And we choose our whether we like something or not based on how hard it is to prep. So that's just conjecture on my part.
No, of course.
No, hopefully I think a lot of people would say, a little bit detached from our food systems in general. But then that extrapolates into what we're willing to give in terms of our time and our effort when we're at home, when we're cooking.
The least, the better.
But yeah, for me personally, the more interactive, the better. That's why I like cracking crab. That's why I like, you know, big pots of fondue or shabu shabu. You know, all these kind of communal ways of eating. And the artichoke is a bit like that. You know, you're really involved in the process of, you know, peeling the leaves and eating it. But I think where people start to begin to get intimidated is maybe even just picking them out, because it's not a super common everyday vegetable that you're going to have. Even, you know, being in Washington State, we're a little bit more familiar with asparagus and how to prep asparagus to a certain extent. The artichoke feels a little bit more special. And so when it comes to going to the grocery store, they have a little bit of a higher ticket price.
They can be up to $5 a piece now.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm with you that it is. I have commonly found artichoke that were soft. and a soft artichoke, when you touch it, like the whole thing, the leaves and the heart, the bottom, that is definitely not a good artichoke. You know, you want an artichoke that is firm.
Firm and heavy for its size. Correct. And almost squeaky when you give it a squeeze. It should be verdant green and a nice tight bulb. What else do you look for when you're looking at these beautiful
artichokes? It should feel
artichokes.
Like a, you know, when you buy a Dungeness crab and you have two different crabs. You get one that's pretty light and the other one that's pretty heavy.
Mm-hmm. But they're the same size.
That is the same size. Mm-hmm. That's exactly the way. You want the heavy one. You want that... that feel of like something that's really full and got the right
meaty.
Weight. Yeah, meaty. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think to me, it's like you also don't want them too big. I mean, there are some artichoke on the market sometimes that are just giant. I think that's overgrown, and I think it's not necessarily better by any stretch of imagination. Mm. You know, you want to look for an artichoke bottom that is no bigger than probably, what is that, 3-4 inches? 3 inches across?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what you want to look for, not too giant. And also... there is plenty of small baby artichoke on the market, which that's a different usage for those, but those are delicious as well. You know, and you don't have to do, if they're really young artichoke, they don't have those pick in there.
They don't have the choke yet.
They don't have the choke, so it's just arty. It's not choke.
Mm. Well, the thing is, and I don't know where you're seeing those, but I rarely see baby artichokes
in
the market.
Yeah, it's very,
either,
very
either
rare.
Grocery store
PCC
or marketplace.
PCC will carry them occasionally, but I'm with you. Mm-hmm. I rarely see the tender little baby artichokes that you can kind of just barely trim up.
The same vegetable as a $5 big one, so if you think about a baby one, it would have to be more expensive.
I think I like to think of artichokes in a couple of different ways. One is, mostly I think of them as an appetizer, so that it's a shareable thing because of the way the leaves are set up. So basically, let's say you've picked your nice firm artichoke.
Uh-huh.
It's heavy for its size.
Right.
You've brought it home. I would say half the ones I see these days don't have stickers on them anymore.
Correct. They've cut them already.
Or they just are bred without them.
Oh,
but
maybe.
If they have stickers, you go through and you cut off the stickers.
Mm-hmm.
Just one by one, literally, that's what you have to do. Or you'll take a knife to the top and cut off the rest. And then for me, if I'm just doing a steamed artichoke, I put it upside down in a steamer rack over boiling water.
Right.
And I like to add some aromatics to my boiling water,
always.
A little white wine or vermouth or some lemon peel or some garlic or something. And I just steam it until I can put a
fork
bamboo skewer into it, and it's tender, right? It just feels tender. Then I pull it out. I leave it upside down, and I just let it cool to the spot where I want it. Or you can serve it.
Explain why you put it upside
serve
down.
It, popping. Piping hot, too.
Yeah. Why are you keeping it upside down?
Well, the leaves, the steam can go right up into the leaves and cook the center of the artichoke, unlike if it was right side up from the bottom.
And also it drains the artichoke.
It drains the artichoke from being too wet. So then there's two ways to do this now. Now you can just put one at each place setting, and you have an artichoke. You put a little thing of butter or mayo, and you simply start dipping your leaves and scrape the inside of the leaf on your bottom teeth, which
love
is
it.
The best part.
Love it.
If you want to get a little bit more fancy, you take that artichoke that's been steamed, you cut it in half, and you, as the host, scoop out the choke and serve that artichoke to the guest.
Bottom, the heart.
With so they don't have to mess with the choke.
Right. This is
if you want to get even more fancy, put it on your, put a little olive oil on it, not too much, because you don't want soot. But put it over a charcoal fire at this point.
Delicious.
And give it a nice hard char, and it gets a little bit smoky and a little bit caramelized.
Dice it, put it in a little salad.
You can't put that big artichoke in the salad just because it's still got all the harsh leaves on it. So if you want to cut, tell them how to cut the choke out.
So the best way to cut an artichoke that I know of is to first take your artichoke, lay it down on its side.
So can we go back for 1 second? So are you now, so I'm asking you to tell them how to get the heart out. Are you taking all the outside leaves off?
Right.
Okay.
I'm going to do a raw version first because I like to use artichoke bottom, just the heart. I mean, I use the leaf, I steam the leaf on the side, but I like to use the heart for example. I used to do a dish at Rover's, which was basically squab breast with a little mousse on the bottom, mousseline of meat, force meat. Put that in the artichoke bottom, wrap it up in crepinette, and bake it in the oven with a little bit of jus on the bottom. So you basically braise the artichoke bottom with the squab in it, and it's really delicious. It's tender. I just love that. It's a good starch. But to peel an artichoke, lay it on its side, break the tail off, that stem, just break it off with your hand, then take a knife and make a platform on the bottom of the artichoke. So just basically cut your, put your knife and run it around so you, your bottom of your artichoke is flat, and then gently cut all the leaves. And it's a little bit of a trick because it takes a little work to do. It's pretty hard to do because the leaves are hard. But run your small knife all around your artichoke.
A paring knife.
Paring knife. Yeah. All around your artichoke in a rotation as you rotate your artichoke bottom, and then keep going all the way around until your artichoke bottom is clear. And then cut straight across just below the beard. And now you have an artichoke bottom that is raw and that is ready to use. So you can slice that super thin, sauteed in brown butter with some toasted pine nuts and lots of fresh shallots.
Let's go back for 1 second, because where's the choke? Have you taken the choke out?
The chokes are all out. By the time you peel the whole thing, all the leaves are out.
On the outside, but there's still a choke attached to the heart.
And then I
to the heart.
Take my knife and cut straight through on the from the art bottom. You know, the
across the equator.
I understand, but you still have to scoop the
bottom. You scoop a little bit of that hair that's left in there, obviously. And then now you have a raw bottom, and then you can just slice that super thin and then pan-sauteed. I like it pan-sauteed with toasted pine nuts, shallots, and a little bit drop of cherry in there. Mm-hmm. And then finish that and use that as a garnish for veal.
Whatever. As a vegetable.
Yeah, as a vegetable, as a side vegetable. Yeah. It's really, I love
it. And as it browns, you know, it's going to start to brown as you are peeling because it's going to take you quite a while.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
You're going to cook it anyway, and it turns green when you cook it.
So. And it's fine, exactly.
People freak out about that unnecessarily. Anyway, that's just one way.
Correct.
Or two ways, I guess, to handle an artichoke. There's many, many more. Have fun with that, and don't be scared. That's what I say. Up next, it's should you buy a smoking gun? When do you add your salt to your pasta water? We're answering your culinary quandaries on these topics and more on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's time for questioners from our listeners here on the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society. Sadly, we have no live audience today, but if you want to join us at a future live show, please go to hotstovesociety.com and join in. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Roach, your older chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O. And as you said, Tom, it is questions from our listeners, and we have quite a few, so people must be cooking up a storm and butting up against some questions. The first one comes from Mandy DeFields. And she would like to know, what are your thoughts on the smoking guns available for home cooks? Worth buying or no? I tend to think they are something with very limited application and that the novelty might wear off pretty quickly. Do they, in fact, work well? If you use one, for what?
Mm-hmm. Well, Terry, I don't know if you use them at this point. But
I don't. I've used them a couple of times in my life, but they're a little bit of a... It's called a fun toy. You don't need to have that in your kitchen. You can make a smoker out of just about anything. You know, all you need is a little bit of wood chip and then a grill, and then put your meat or your fish or your whatever you want to smoke on top of that. Cover the whole thing up after you burn the wood, and then you get a smoker. It's not... Mm-hmm. It's very simple to make a smoker in your house. It's not hard.
Yeah, in a wok or...
Yeah.
You know, but the thing I would say about them is that it is... an easy trick for a one-time application. And so in a restaurant scenario, these little smoking guns are a little bit like an air paint gun, right?
Yeah.
So you put maybe a quarter teaspoon of
wood
sawdust into the bowl, and you light it, and you can do smoking for one in 2 minutes, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't last more than a minute or two.
Yeah, if you want to present something that is covered with a glass dome on top of a soup bowl and have the smoke in there, it's kind of a fun thing to do.
It's kind of fun, but how often do you do that at
home?
At a restaurant, you might serve that dish 50 times in a night.
Right.
But at home, maybe not. So I think they're fun. They're a novelty. They're not expensive. If you're a chef or a home cook that likes to have everything, yes, absolutely, grab one.
My pet peeve about that in a restaurant is it's nice to serve it in a restaurant if everybody's having that. It's a little bit of a inconvenience if the guy next to you is not having a smoked item and you lift up that dome and the whole restaurant smells like smoke.
It can be
a little bit of a... It's kind of like, I didn't want to smell this.
Do you remember at Rover's when you invited me to be guest chef? I did a steak with the smoking bush. And I did a little seared steak, because you never serve steak at Rover's.
That's right.
I did a little sprig of rosemary as the bush and put it under a glass, and everyone's supposed to lift off the glass as it was set down.
But he made it as a kind of a joke. You know?
Oh, like, not me, never.
Never as a joke. All right. Next question comes from Jean Parton Russell. She says, I'm brining a 5-pound brisket. End result being corned beef to serve at Easter? I'm an experienced home cook, but I've never done this before. Am I in over my head?
Absolutely not. Follow the rule. Follow the recipe you started with, and you should be more than fine. Brining the meat is not that big of a deal. I mean, you should be able to follow the recipe and then rinse off your piece of meat and then put all new seasoning on top if you've been brining it for 3-4 days. And then you should have a wonderful piece of brisket on your hand. Don't burn it. Don't overcook it. You can't really... It's hard to overcook brisket, I think. If you cook it slowly, it's pretty hard to cook. But when it becomes fork tender, your brisket is ready. Take it out of the pan, finish your sauce, and then you get a wonderful slice of brisket.
We just have a couple of different opinions here.
Okay, go ahead.
One is, you know, brining a brisket takes a few days.
Yes, it does.
So just make sure you look up online or something, what a classic. But I think it could be in the brine for up to a week or longer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, when it sits there in the plastic package at the grocery store, it's still in brine.
Right.
And the other thing you said is to rinse it off. I would not rinse it off.
Well, it depends on
to me, if you're going to cook that, you might want to cook it. My mother always boiled it in water to leach some of the salt out, you know, and that's just how she cooked her brisket.
Right.
But I always bake it with a water bath. And then that also leaches some salt out, and it becomes fork tender. But you also get a brown crispiness because I leave the spices on the top, and they all brown up the mustard seeds, the coriander seed, chilies.
They all kind of brown up and
become part of the brisket. So we just have a few things. If you're making it without being corned, is another story.
I agree. You can cook the meat just by itself and braise it very slowly. Give it a little sear first, then put it in the pan. Vegetables, little stock. Braise it very slowly for a very long time. So slowly is about 300, 325 in the oven, probably 4 or 5 hours, depends on the piece of brisket. But a 5-pound brisket, I would say, takes about 4 or 5 hours. And cook it very slowly, monitor it, and don't forget to, once in a while, take a ladle and baste it, you know, on top, so it keeps that moisture going through and that flavor too.
So you have to degrease, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, in the end, you have to degrease totally because there's a lot of grease melting down.
All right. Another question comes from Michelle, and she wants to go back to basics and talk to her favorite chefs, which is you two, about something that is potentially an old wives' tale. When cooking pasta, do you or do you not salt the water? When and why?
Well, to me, this is a little bit of a funny thing because pretty much every chef I know says salt the water.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, those are the same chefs that say use unsalted butter so you can control the salt.
Right.
Right? So I find it to be a little bit of a miss.
I think the salt in the water is just to help the fact that pasta is not salted. So if you put a little bit of salt, you'll have a little base of salt, not a lot. But you don't need to put salt in water. You don't need to put anything in water when you cook pasta. You know, it's the same fairy tale with the olive oil and all that stuff. You don't need to put anything. Boil water, cook your pasta. What's more important is what you're going to do next. What are you going to do to make the pasta soak up a little bit of that jus? First of all, always keep a little bit of that poaching liquid. That's your little base of moisture. I'm a big fan of lots of butter in that pan. Make a quick emulsion with that water. Put the pasta back in. Then you season. Now, if you're going to make a tomato sauce, obviously your tomato sauce, you strongly season it, and then that takes care of that. You toss your pasta in there so the pasta can swallow all that different flavors that you have in there and stick to it.
Yeah. I just think it's easier to control salt if you don't salt your
water.
Yeah. Okay.
Especially if you walk away.
All right. Sherry wants to know, I'm behind on my podcasts as I enjoy them so much. I play them over once or twice. Thanks, Sherry. Before moving on to the next show, Tom mentioned baking frozen beef roast. Would this also apply to frozen pork?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
It really doesn't matter if a frozen leg of lamb.
Yeah.
Depends on what you want to at the end of the day, right? If you're going for anything sort of braised and fall off the bone.
Correct.
Cooking from frozen is not a problem. You're cooking low and slow, and it just takes a little longer, right?
You know,
you're cooking an ice cube rather than just something that's already up.
Right. I haven't tried a whole chicken, but that's something I should put on my things to do. A whole frozen chicken, I haven't tried that. Mm. I would think it would fall apart on the outside because it's such a massive piece
and
of
the
rock.
Bones and
I just
the
think it's slow and slow is the key when you're cooking from
frozen. Right, no,
like
for
that.
Sure.
Although when I did a lamb rack, I did it in a hot cast iron pan, gave it a hard sear, and then just baked it in the oven.
Perfectly
to
delicious.
Rare.
Okay. Beverly Kid wants to know, I always saute onions before I put it in soup, stews, casseroles, but I want to ask, do you saute with meat or bacon or all by itself?
All by itself. It depends on what you're doing, but I would say start with all by yourself. So like this, if you have too many onions, you can keep them on the side and use them for something else. That would be my first.
Yeah, I think it depends on what you're making, mm-hmm. right? So if you're making pot roast, I don't have any problem with putting the onion in at the same time you're browning the pot roast.
Yep.
But if you're making stir fry, mm-hmm. to me, you want to make sure that the onions get their sear so that they don't just steam with all the other vegetables.
Right.
So I would steam those or stir fry those separate. And matter of fact, I would stir fry each of the different ingredients separately mm-hmm. and then put them all back in for the last saucing.
I was actually just thinking about like a chowder and like cutting up some nice salt pork or bacon and getting that crisp, removing it, then adding your onions and having kind of that meaty flavor infused in your onions and as the base of your soups.
Yeah. If you're cooking with bacon, you should always render the bacon first, then use the fat.
Use the fat, yeah.
All right.
And I'm going to end with this because I think it's a little bit relevant. We only have a minute. But last night I made a dish. I called it Hoisin Barbecue Lamb Mushu. And I did lamb loins like off the racks. And I barbecued the racks separately so you had little mini ribs, riblets. Had the nice hoisin barbecue lamb. But then I made the mushu. It was like a stir fry. And I did the cabbage separate, the shiitakes, the onions. I added fresh pea vines and fresh basil and cilantro and green onions and garlic chives. And I just made this delicious kind of
vegetable
really
stew.
Lightly stir-fried, almost like a warm salad.
Mm-hmm.
But my cheater trick was I got the, you know, in the freezer department of some of the stores now, Wajamaya, Shoreline Central Market, beautiful green onion pancakes, frozen, ready to be just pan-fried in vegetable oil.
Sure.
So that was my base. A nicely browned green onion pancake was my base. Spread it with a little bit of hoisin sauce, and then put my fresh mushu salad on top. Bean sprouts, pea sprouts, all sorts of deliciousness. And then a little bit of seared barbecued lamb on top of it.
Sounds
gotta say, there's some cheater things out there that
I see you.
Are really nice.
I see you, Tom. Yes. This is a good sounding meal right there.
Sounds like a very delicious meal.
I guess my point was, don't be afraid to cheat a little. Get a little head start on some things. What you eat for your last day on Earth, we're taking a note from your last meal and choosing our final dishes for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the final countdown right here on Cairo Radio. We got a question from Stephen Lally on the Facebook page. It seemed like it was meant for a good discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So, Katie, what is it?
His question was, it's the final day for our two chefs on Earth. What are they going to each have for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Wow.
Well, there you go.
Doomsday.
That's
Doomsday.
A long day. Can you imagine the final day, but you have to choose all three meals? It's like, it's not bad enough you get to choose the last one.
I know.
But now you got to have all three.
Pressure's on.
Yeah.
Well, I know what I'm having for breakfast if it's my last day.
Okay, go through
I'm having that famous memorabilia trail that I've always wanted, which is a hot bowl of chocolate made with fresh drawn milk from the cows. The country bread toasted with a fork in the fireplace and the beautiful salted butter right spread right on top of that and dunking into my hot chocolate.
Sounds
That's
good.
My breakfast, and I want a lot of it because this is delicious stuff.
All right. So lunch?
Lunch, I'm going to go with a cheese omelette with a mushroom. Cheese mushroom omelette. Very simply done. Runny, please do not overcook my omelette.
God, not for your last omelette. Better not be overcooked.
Better not be overcooked. And a little, nice little fresh, bright green salad next to it.
Okay.
Are you having anything to drink? Isn't that kind of the whole meal? Like,
well,
you're very French.
I was going to go into the beverage later on. For breakfast, we'll just stick to the hot chocolate.
Okay.
But for lunch, I'll definitely do a nice bottle of reminiscing of... Do you remember our dinner or lunch at... dinner at Jean-Georges Van Rieken 20-some years ago with a magnum of Silex... Dididier Dagneau, 1990. I want that wine again.
Okay.
That wine was, I still taste it today. So beautiful. With that omelette, it would be beautiful.
Okay.
And then for dinner, I want my mom to make me a beautiful pot-au-feu. Because that's...
The pot roast.
The pot roast. Mm-hmm. Boiled.
Boiled.
It's boiled,
beef, yeah.
So with all the vegetable, all the accoutrement, the cornichon, the salt, the mustard, the piquant Dijon mustard... And all those beautiful vegetables from the garden next to it, the turnips, the carrots, the onion, the cabbage, and that little juicy, the whole thing juicy, and then that sliced beef in my bowl, and then eat the heck out of it. And with that, I'm going to drink the most, some beautiful, beautiful 25-year-old Burgundy, Le Musigny from Roumier, and that would be a delicious bottle of wine. I'm excited already. When do we do this?
When do we die?
The nice thing about this, I feel like you can do this any day, too. You could do this weekend.
The point is I could do it, but I'm like, you know.
Live every day like it's your last.
I always live like that.
Tom, what would you feast on for your last day?
And by the way, did I mention I would like my wife and my kids to be with me?
Yes, we're just making
on
that
the last
assumption.
Meal.
We're making that assumption.
Boy, I don't know. Mine goes from the traditional things that you grow up with to the Lola breakfast, which is so popular here at the Lola restaurant. I guess for me, what I make at home the most for breakfast is some Pennsylvania Dutch scrapple. Really crispy, lots of pig snouts and livers and ears and eyes and nose and tails and all ground up with cornmeal.
You know what's so funny? I was out to lunch the other day, and someone who was sitting at the bar where we were sitting, it was a little sushi place, was talking about scrapple. And I was like, I only know this from Tom Douglas. It's the only reason I have any idea what they're talking about.
There you go. See? Yeah. Well, I mean, it was just the perfect way to use up all the scrap. That from butchering the hog, right? So it was easy, and cornmeal's cheap, and he grew the corn and dried it and ground it. And
sure.
Very, very much Pennsylvania Dutch. So from there, that gets real maple syrup after it's pan-fried nice and crispy.
That's what makes it swallowable.
Oh, no.
You eat that, drawn that maple syrup on top of that.
And then I got to say, pho has become an important part of my life. And a nice big bowl of pho for lunch will leave space for dinner, but also makes you feel full for a while, but it doesn't overfill you, and at least a space for a beautiful roast duck dinner, just low and slow over the charcoal grill on the rotisserie. And I just literally I put a pan of potatoes underneath the rotisserie to catch all that duck fat. And the potatoes simply stew in duck fat until they're creamy on the inside and a little greasy on the outside. Very good. And then I love asparagus. I think, a nice grilled asparagus with my duck. So I think that would be a nice combination. Yeah. From a beverage standpoint, I collect Nebbiolos.
Yes.
So I would have a large bottle of the Barolo Mascarello Barolo from the little town just by Alba. And,
Tom, not on
that. I have a Scotch whiskey to finish.
Yeah, and not on I listen to you, I'm like, man, all those things sounds good, too. I mean,
yeah, I know. They also
it's kind of like dying with just one meal. It sounds like not a cup of tea, so I'll make a shoe when I survive that day to be another day ahead and try. Because I must agree with you that the bowl of oxtail pho from Baba would definitely be on my list, because I've had hundreds of those. And
the Baba pho is too strong for me. I like the lighter, brothier version of pho bak, where you just have the braised flank steak in it or brisket in it. But for lunch, I would go back and make sure that I open the bottle of rosé, either the Bandol, Tempié Bandol rosé, or the Castella d'Ama Tuscan Sangiovese rosé.
The Mene Tempié is delicious.
Yes, I love that one.
That sounds delicious. I would definitely put pho on my breakfast list. It's actually my favorite breakfast food. That with a little latte.
I could have it anytime.
Chinese donut on the side. I'm into it.
Vietnamese latte with a condensed milk?
No, not necessarily. I don't really like my coffee super sweet like that. But, a nice little latte. Then go into your bowl of pho with that Chinese
donut.
What
would you have for lunch?
For lunch? That's a great question. Something vegetable heavy. I love vegetables. It's kind of funny to say my favorite food is broccoli. But I really do get excited by really delicious in-season vegetables. As Tom was saying, asparagus. We were talking about artichokes earlier on the show. Just a big
medley.
Maybe a crudité platter. Just get it all in.
One last healthy meal.
One last healthy meal, finally. And then probably for dinner, as you both were talking about, memories of, is it the thing that you love when you go out? Is it the thing that you grew up with? And I would say one thing that I've never been able to get anywhere else other than at my family's table is Japanese New Year's dinner. And that has so many things in it, really traditional things that have been passed down throughout generations, whether it's a burdock root or lotus root, or if it's just a delicious glazed chicken wing or a fried wonton filled with pork. That's what I would want on my last meal.
There's just so many meals once I start thinking about it.
Drinks, beverages?
Drinks and beverages.
Are you going out?
Ooh, I like a good gin and tonic. I like a good gin martini. Apparently, I like gin. I think you know this about me,
me
Todd.
Me too.
You know this about me, Terry. But, you know, I don't know. It just, with that pho, I think a little, like, sparkly, little gingery, you know, non-alcoholic something sounds great. Midday, I think that's when you start cocktailing, getting really prepared for the end of your life. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think all day sipping. If I knew it was my last day, I'd probably be sipping on champagne all day as well, in between everything, because I'm a big fan of champagne at any time, any place, anywhere. I like the idea of a nice magnum of Bilker Saumon, you know, something like that. That would be a nice...
What, at the end of the day, if you had to come back after you died as what you ate... And wait your own fate.
Mm. Oh, I want to be that roast.
So I'll be a duck.
I want to be that roast pork sandwich I had in bone
you're gonna be
once.
A pig. I'll be a duck.
Yeah, I was going to be a pig. I want to be one of those pigs and cow and get nice and crispy and
skin.
Delicious. Yeah.
The reason I want to be the pig is because you can use everything from the pig except for the hoof.
Tina, who is plant based diet, is over here kind of like squinching her nose. Like, are we talking about
She's coming back as an acorn.
She'd come back as a vegetable garden.
All right. It's time for Taste of the Week. Stay with us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the kitchen on Cairo Radio. Thanks for hanging during that long break. I'm Tom Douglas, and it's time for our Taste of the Week. I'm joined by Katie O.
That's right.
Nice to see you again. And the chef in the chapeau, Chef Terry Rotereau.
Yes, Mr. Douglas.
So, Chef, are you still...
Yes, I am very much reminiscing of Peru, and you know that's coming for my Taste of the Week.
Mm-hmm. I hope it's not the corn nuts that you brought this week.
It is actually related to that.
Oh, we're bringing up the corn nuts.
We're bringing
up
the corn nuts. First of all, I don't think they're called corn nuts, but...
Cusco.
Cusco.
Well, the brand is Cusco, but the main...
Picos del Cusco.
Yeah,
and maize Chulpi con ricotta.
Right. Yeah. And it's choclo. Basically, choclo. What I want to talk about is not exactly this, because these are dried and they're salted and, you know, made as a little corn nut, like you call it. I'm talking about the same corn, but big, giant kernel of something called choclo in Peru.
So is it like hominy?
It's like a corn kernel.
Okay.
But it's big. It's like, you know, we used to see corn kernel here, you know, the certain size. These are twice as big. They're not starchy because usually when the corn gets bigger here, it gets very starchy. It's very nice and tender. But this, what's interesting is I had it in almost every ceviche that I had in Peru, which is interesting because I've never seen corn in ceviche before, but there in Peru, it seems like a trend and they're putting corn in ceviche. And that was actually really surprising, but very delicious. Marinated fish. The fish for the ceviche, their trick is make sure you put it in salt first for about 20 minutes, as in season the fish heavily in salt.
So you've got the fresh fish, it's all cut up, and now you season heavily in salt?
Big cubes of fish.
Okay.
You put it in salt, and you put a heavy amount of salt, and you toss it in there, and you let it sit for about 20 minutes. While you're doing that, you're slicing your onions. You're taking your cilantro, the corn kernel, those big corn kernel, tossing the whole thing together with lemon, which is the green. It's like their lemon, except it's lime color, basically. It's green and very, very limey flavor. So you put that whole thing to marinate together. And at the last minute, you put the fish into the whole thing with some ice cube to keep the fish really cold. And toss the whole thing together. And I've seen that 3 times, been done that way. And it tastes really beautiful, fresh. The other thing that's added to it is a little bit of that ai pepper, the red or yellow pepper, diced super small and put in there at the last minute. But, you know, ceviche, I mean, I've made ceviche, or what I call ceviche, many times in my life, making it a little bit more complicated than it should be, apparently. I used olive oil, but they don't put any of that. It's just straight lemon juice, and a little bit of ice cube. So basically a little bit of water. And that's what makes the ceviche. And that was absolutely, obviously the fish is very important. But
Sounds good. I would eat that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's also, when you say you've made it differently, what ceviche is made differently all over the world, right?
That's right. Right. But, I mean, Peru is, that's their national dish. So let's start from where it is from.
Well, I went to Portland. I had a wild weekend from my little sister's bachelorette party. And it's always a good excuse to get down there because I feel like every time I go to Portland, I'm like, geez, why don't I come down here more frequently? It's not that far away. There's a whole different kind of food and restaurant scene. And there were some things that honestly have been around in Portland for a while that I just haven't had the opportunity to try and dine in. But one of those things was Nong's. Nong's Chicken and Rice. It started as a food truck, and now they have a brick and mortar spot, a little walk-up counter. And it was delicious.
How do you spell Nong's?
Nong's, N-O-N-G apostrophe S. And it's just really just a chicken and rice spot, which I love concepts like that, where you go and you get one thing, and that's pretty much all they do. There's a little accompaniment.
But they do it well.
Yeah, you can get, but they do that, and they do it really well. And such a simple dish. Honestly, I wasn't all that excited about going, you know, I can't really think of times when I'm just like, ooh, I'd love some steamed chicken over rice. That doesn't really get me going. But it lived up to the hype in that it was this very simple thing that was incredibly flavorful. It's a steamed chicken, as I just said. You can get livers on the side. You can get crispy chicken skin. But it's on this very fragrant rice that I'm pretty sure they steam with like a master chicken stock. And then what you have on the side is a little bit of that broth with, I think, a winter melon that's been kind of stewed in there. And then a sauce that you pour on top of that steamed chicken and rice that's full of umami flavors like ginger and a little bit of garlic and soy, I'm sure, is in there as well. So that was my taste of the week. Right up there was Blue Star Donuts. I love a good donut. And it, you know, those donuts probably save some lives the next morning after a night out. And just going into that space and, you know, as we've talked about, sometimes the things that you love in terms of food are so much more than the food itself. It, at the end of the day, it's a donut. It was a delicious glazed, you know, original kind of yeasted donut. But it was the experience of going and having people working behind the counter who were just really gracious and fun. And it just made for a really lovely morning.
Sounds so fun. I'm ready for a trip to Portland.
Yeah, it's super fun.
Mine is, you know, right now the chickens at our farm are starting to lay again in a big way. So we're getting about 12 to 18 eggs a day at this point. And so there's this looking around like, what do we do with all these eggs? And it's Easter, and you think about that, right? Our eggs are from many different chickens, so they all have different colors, so that you don't have to dye the eggs. That's kind of a cool thing.
It's already done.
It's already done for you. Made an angel food cake for the first time. Jackie did for the first time this season. And I think of it as a perfect kind of brunch. You know, brunch you tend to overindulge. Mm-hmm. It's a perfect kind of brunch dessert. So light and fluffy. But she made hers in a way that had a nice brown crust on it, which is sometimes without too much sugar, it's hard to do.
Right.
So that was good. So yeah, that took care of all the whites. And then a little creme anglaise with all the
yolks.
And then for a little garnish on top, she did blood orange supremes, which this is it. If you want blood oranges, now's the time.
This is it.
They're starting to disappear.
Yep.
And then made our own little hazelnut, not really brittle. We took candied hazelnuts and then just put them in the Cuisinart for a second to make a little crunch, a hazelnut crunch
to
kind of sprinkle on top. So lots of good textures. She had done some of our Chinese 12-spice spice rub in the cake itself, so it had a little kind of Asian flavor.
Well,
we were serving it after our lamb mushu. And so it was just a really nice finish. I forget how good angel food cake can be. And what a nice light finish it can be. Mm-hmm. So there you go. That's my taste of the week.
Excellent.
Speaking of brunch, let's do Easter brunch. Let's do it at your house.
Okay,
hopefully
let's go.
Hopefully you have all the party items that we need.
Plastic eggs. I'm sure that I do, yes.
Okay. And then after that, we're going to learn how to cook rice, because Katie O is having a hard time cooking rice.
Boy, oh boy. I know. It's shameful.
All up next on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's Easter, and we're celebrating with a little brunch at Katie O's house.
Right.
I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O, the host of this brunch party. And you two chefs are coming over to my place, and you're making all the food. Yeah? Sound good?
Well, it depends. Who's coming? Who's our guest of honor?
The Easter Bunny. It's Easter brunch.
Oh, really? Are we cooking the Easter Bunny, or are we actually eating the Easter Bunny?
Really up to you. When you see this magical, mythical creature, though, I feel like you'll have the impulse to maybe leave him be and use your know-how in other ways.
What about if we invite Elmer Fudd so we don't have to do the dirty work?
There you go.
Or Alice in Wonderland.
Although Elmer was never very successful.
No, he never did catch the bunny, did he?
No, he was not very good at that.
Okay.
All right, so let's do Easter brunch. That is the theme. Got the Easter Bunny coming over. I've got all the decor set up, all the pastel colors.
We'll be the judge of that, of the decor.
Fine.
Is there something in your Easter brunch that traditionally you have to have on your table every year?
Oh, gosh. I love a lemony dessert.
Okay.
I love eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they're in the form of deviled eggs or quiche.
I was going to do that.
Eggs are kind of a must.
Because I think these kind of meals... traditions often take over, right? It doesn't mean you have to make it the same way, but like if you always have deviled eggs, there's a million ways to do deviled eggs. Or if you always have a lemon chiffon cake with coconut icing on the outside, you know, shaped it like
a
bunny.
I'm already excited about this meal. So how about if we make brunch?
That's what I'm saying. But so there's not an entree dish that you have to have.
I think we should just use eggs. Eggs in everything.
It's Easter. Let's use eggs.
Right. I'm starting with blood orange mimosas. Because I think a little bubble and a little fresh OJ in the morning or the mid-afternoon, whatever your time. I think that's a great place to start.
Sounds delicious.
And it looks festive, right? Because the blood orange is all red orange juice. And,
Beautiful.
There you go.
I'm into it.
I'm going to do some devil egg with crab.
I think devil egg,
you know, nice hard-boiled egg, cut them in half, take the yolk out, make a nice, beautiful aioli, and then, of course, adding some wonderful Dungeness crab meat to that whole seasoning, mayonnaise, egg yolks, bunch of fresh herbs, chives, and then putting this back in the middle of your egg white that's been hollowed, and put your crab salad right in there. That makes a nice little tray of devil egg crab salad.
Yum. Okay. So I've got a little bit of a buzz on from Tom's blood orange mimosa. I've had some crab on my deviled eggs, making it very, very classy. Mm-hmm. What's next, Tom?
Well, for me, you know, right now, rosés are being introduced into the marketplace, the 2018 rosés, or 19?
No, 18.
2018 rosés.
Yeah, 19 is not harvested yet.
Correct. Are being introduced into the marketplace. So I'm going to get big magnums because I think magnums are festive and they're not in rosé. They're not super expensive.
Very party-esque.
Very party-esque. And I think that I'm going to go now into a big pile of grilled asparagus. Get out my charcoal grill, and I like, for grilled asparagus, I like to go pretty darn hot, high fire. Not fire so much, but hot heat, high coals, and then give a nice char. Asparagus has got plenty of sugar in it, so it chars up beautifully. And as soon as you get the char on it, that's all you want to cook it. You want it to be kind of raw in the center. And then because it's brunch, I'm going to make a little hollandaise sauce or a little béarnaise, one or the other, and I'm going to drizzle my hollandaise sauce over top of my grilled asparagus.
Mm. And remind people, what is the difference between a béarnaise versus a hollandaise?
Chef, shallot, tarragon, and red wine vinegar is what I think of.
So that's béarnaise, and then hollandaise is just basic shallots, white wine, and white wine vinegar.
Ooh, I've never put shallots in
lemon,
my hollandaise.
Lemon, pardon me. Lemon.
Say.
Have you ever put shallots in your hollandaise?
No, it's in the base when you...
I never have, I'm just saying.
Ah,
You should try it.
It's good, a good flavor in the reduction.
But what is traditional? It's not traditional.
Traditional is lemon juice and white wine.
Yeah. Lots of butter.
Lots of butter,
lots of egg yolks. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the basics of a good hollandaise. And once you get a hollandaise, you can add glace de viande or, you know, reduce stock, you know, and you can add tomato. If you have a great tomato sauce, you can add that to your hollandaise. Yeah, I mean, those are all the classic fresh herbs, tarragon.
You didn't know I knew sauce Chiron.
No,
you?
I'm impressed.
Yeah.
Sauce foyau with the reduced glass de viande, you know, all
you
the
know,
classic.
You've been friends for so long, but she really, you still learn things
yeah.
about one another.
Okay, what are we having for an entree there,
yeah.
bud?
Well, I think for me, Easter, I think lamb. You know, a nice young lamb, leg of lamb, butterflied, pounded, you know, cut down all the way to the same height mm-hmm. everywhere, rolled out, seasoned. Beautiful fresh sage, rosemary, olive oil, olives. Put all that on top of your leg of lamb for a couple of hours so it really impregnates the flavor. Mm-hmm. Remove all that, throw in the grill, no flame underneath. Really give it a nice grilling, nice char on both sides. Not char as in flame, but char as in really high heat and very nicely cooked on both sides. And I like my lamb to be cooked medium, not less than medium. Let it rest. Slice super thin, put it on the platter, and then take the what you remove, all that olives and everything, put it in the pan with a little bit of olive oil and a dash of lemon, and then toss the whole thing hot right on top of the lamb as you're ready to serve it. And then you'd have a wonderful olive lamb, spring olive lamb.
Mm. Wow.
Maybe some little lavender if you have a little bit, just a little bit added to that tapenade and give it a little southern France touch. And then here we go.
Couple of side dishes for me to go along with everything. Cherry almond scones. I think a nice warm scone. If you want to go savory, a chive scone is really a delicious alternative.
Yeah.
I serve that sometimes with a seafood chowder, a nice little fresh chive mm-hmm. scone.
Little dips. You could do little dips for like peas, young peas, you know, make mm-hmm. a nice little pea hummus kind of idea.
Pea salad. I mean, springtime. It's pea
yeah,
salad time.
Yeah.
Pea salads.
Goat cheese fondue with apples and grilled bread. Just little things on the side. Because brunch, you want to have a little bit of this and that, right? It seems to me.
Yes, little bites of everything is what
And then for
I
dessert,
like.
You said lemon, right? Is your
I
kind
love
of your,
lemon, yeah.
What's your favorite lemon dessert?
Oh, I have so many. I do love just the perfect lemon bar.
Just a lemon bar?
Yeah. I know that I seems kind of basic, but I
How about
but
lemon
I really
meringue
enjoy
pie?
Them. You know,
or
sometimes
lemon tart, like just
a little tart would be great.
Yeah.
Depends who's making that lemon meringue pie. They can get real funky, real fat. Okay, mm-hmm. then yes.
It won't be a pie, it'll be a tart.
There we go.
I make a lemon custard and then a nice Italian meringue and pipe that right on top.
I think that's what's key is the Italian meringue versus some of the other versions of meringue that maybe get a little weepy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
yeah.
So that one would not get weepy. And you just flambé with a blowtorch right on top. Nice little Bernay. Mm-hmm.
Tom, I want you to bring your famous peeps.
Yes.
Your flambéed peeps.
Absolutely. I always have a fire going in my house. I don't know if you have a fireplace or not, but you can use the gas stove. But you put your little peep chicks, you put them on a stick, and then you put them over the fire and turn slowly, and you have chick on a stick. And you just caramelize the outside. But you have to be careful because that is caramelized sugar.
Yeah, that is.
If you put that right in your mouth,
hot.
You are a dead person.
It's
yeah.
just like a marshmallow. You got to wait a
no
minute.
No more tongue.
No more
enjoying Easter brunch.
At the end, yeah. There's no more roof over your head. So that's my favorite is chicks on a stick. What else for dessert? I think that's plenty. Malted. I love the malted milk ball Easter eggs.
Mm-hmm.
You ever have those?
Yeah, of course. Those are a classic. I went into France the other day. I got to say, their Easter candies are always so fun looking. I want to spend so much money just like cracking open one of those beautiful eggs that they have. With
How about jelly beans? We haven't
inside.
Talked about jelly beans. Exactly. My wife's favorite.
I've sent my mom Fran's candies for different holidays, mm-hmm. and that used to be a surprise to her. Now it's an expectation. So I get a little phone call when they haven't shown up yet.
That's why you have to start the bar low, Tom,
have you sent those beans yet?
It's time for What's Wrong with Katie's Cooking. Coming up next, it's all about rice on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the Seattle kitchen on Cairo Radio. It's Tom Douglas.
Terry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
And Katie O.
And it's time to find out what's wrong with Katie's rice.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, you are...
that's very nice.
You are a family, come from a family that cooked rice pretty much every day.
Yeah.
And I feel like your travails with a very simple rice dish are somewhat unexpected.
I'm disconcerted by the whole scenario, I'll be honest with you. I was so let me back up and say that I grew up in a Japanese American household, and in our house we ate predominantly short grain, mm-hmm. sticky Japanese rice, and that was always made in a rice cooker. It was the workhorse of our kitchen because it was used every single night.
And easy.
And easy and convenient. And when you have many, many kids in a family, you can cook a lot of rice very quickly in this manner. So that's how I grew up. When I moved out of the house, my parents got me a 4-cup rice cooker that is at top of the line. And probably not, but it still cooks rice, and I kind of love it. I have an attachment to it. Like, it's like my security blanket in a funny way. I haven't gotten rid of it and upgraded. That said, I wanted rice pilaf. I had rice pilaf the other day out, and I was like, oh, so delicious, rice pilaf. You know, I don't ever eat this. Like, if I eat rice, again, it's sticky rice. So mm-hmm. I'm just going to make rice pilaf. Went online, as you do. Went to Bon Appetit. They had a recipe for a very basic rice pilaf, and I screwed it up. I don't know what happened. I would say it felt like the rice was undercooked forever. And then all of a sudden, it was just kind of mushy and wet. So,
did you steal the whole time, or did you not steal the whole time?
I did not stir. This okay. recipe was all about like sautéing the aromatics.
Yes.
Adding a little bit of spice. In this case, I had a little bit of turmeric and a little bit of curry that I added to the sweated onions. And most of the water was out of them. They weren't browned by any means, but, you know, they had gone fully translucent and a little soft. And then I added the rice, toasted the rice in the oil, added the chicken stock, and put the lid on.
Cold or hot, the chicken stock?
Chicken stock was cold.
Hot is better.
Hot is better. Okay. Okay.
Just a little.
Great. What else went wrong here, though?
You use oil, not butter?
I used oil.
See, I used butter in my...
I used olive oil.
Rice pilaf. Okay. Rice pilaf is...
But that shouldn't change the outcome.
No. I'm just saying that for flavor purposes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then you bring it to a boil and then you cover it.
Did you say what kind of rice you used?
It was a long grain rice.
Just long grain. Didn't say basmati.
It wasn't basmati necessarily.
I find basmati to hold up really well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why. I'm not a scientist.
The structure.
And jasmine rice, too, is easy to work with.
It sounds like you just over-watered it, overstocked it.
Maybe just too much liquid.
Yeah.
You know, when the Latinos in our kitchens make their lunch, because uh-huh. they just won't eat our lunch most of the time. They like to make their own kind of what they call Mexican rice.
Mm-hmm.
They overcook their rice mm-hmm. all the time. As far as how I like it, to them, it's perfect.
Right.
But as far as how I like it, it's kind of fall apart, almost turning to mush sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And they, and I'm generalizing, obviously, I know, don't write me a letter.
It's just what you've seen. It's
generally
anecdotal.
What I see in the kitchen is that I would always say this rice is overcooked,
mm-hmm.
personally, from
right.
my taste.
Right.
So, maybe all was not lost. Maybe you would have made somebody happy.
Maybe I would have made someone happy. You're right. You're right. Maybe that's the case. And maybe I'm also used to a certain style of rice mm-hmm. growing up with a very specific type.
But sticky rice is a very specific type of rice in terms of texture.
Texturally, it's both soft and sticky, as the name would imply, but it still has its little individual grains, essentially. And so I think what I was a little bit like befuddled by is it felt more like a mass of individual grains than
too much moisture. And sometimes your rice just literally breaks into pieces.
Right.
It doesn't hold its grain when it gets too wet. So it's very simple.
Right.
And it is hard because, they give you recipe for rice and for liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And every grain of rice is actually different. So when you think about that, it has a little temperament. My philosophy in rice for the first time recipe, always put less water.
And then add more.
You can always add more. But if you put too much water and you're waiting for the water to evaporate, you will have an overcooked rice on your hand if you put too much water. Mm. So put a little bit less. If it says a cup and a half, put a cup and a quarter. Get that quarter cup standing on your counter, ready to go in case you need, if it's water or if it's stock, whatever it is. And then if you see as you're touching your rice, if it's really crunchy, just add that quarter cup.
And if it's not, then you'll have the perfect rice on hand.
It was funny, right before we were taping this particular segment, I was telling Tom that I was like, I don't know why I'm doing this wrong. I mean, I can cook risotto. To which he was like, oh, yeah? Well, why don't we talk to someone who's had this risotto? And now I'm questioning the nature of all of my realities when it comes to rice. I don't know what I'm doing.
Here's the other way to look at it. You can just get online with Bon Appetit and say, your dang recipe
does not work, and just become one of those people, just a troll in the comments section. You know, there is that opportunity, I suppose.
You know, risotto in general is actually harder to cook than just
I think maybe I don't feel that way because you're so engaged with it. I think there's something about just steaming a pot of rice that, like, I just can't let well enough alone in a funny way of like, oh, how are you doing in there? Are you okay? Like, you know, you're not a rice cooker. You're not going to tell me when you're done, so I'm going to keep on looking. That might have been part of the problem,
too. I would say, in general, people almost always overcook their rice compared to undercooking it.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And really, it's no different in a rice cooker than it is in a pan with a lid. You put the pan with a lid on low. It's I always go 1:1 unless I'm doing brown rice, and I go 1:1
uh-huh.
because brown rice will just take a little more water. Yeah. If I'm doing wild rice, I'll go 1:3:1 because it takes a lot more water.
Yeah.
But I want my wild rice to have bite still. I want it to be chewy. That's part of the great texture of that rice. Mm-hmm. But if I'm doing sticky rice, no more than 1:1. And by sticky rice, I think I wanted to clarify, we're talking about that Nico Nico rice or Cal Rose.
Yeah, Cal Rose, yeah.
Because I think sometimes people don't. There are other sweet sticky rices out there that I don't want to confuse people with.
Mentioning Carol's, I had maybe a couple pounds of rice in my cupboard that has been there for a long time because it was asked for the kids about 2 years ago when they came to visit, whatever. And for some reason, we always use jasmine rice, other different rice. And yesterday I was looking at that and I cooked that rice. And guess what? To my strange belief, I had no idea. My rice was sour, was rancid. Just water, plain water.
Plain
just
water. Sticky the water rice, wasn't rancid.
Sticky rice, plain rice, sticky rice, just the way it's supposed to be done. It was cooked perfectly. It was just the flavor.
Wow.
The flavor was rancid. I had no idea rice could go rancid. I've never went through that. But it's a two-year-old bag, so I should have used it a long time ago.
Shouldn't be rancid.
Rice confessions.
Well, I can tell you then it went rancid. And
should I tell you about my rice-a-roni story?
Yes.
No, I don't have one. Just kidding. There's no confession.
All those times you were eating rice-a-roni.
Yeah, exactly.
When you're just desperate.
I don't know that I've ever had rice-a-roni.
I've never had
rice-a-roni. I don't think I have. Maybe we should bring a butane burner in here and just fix them up.
It's a San Francisco treat.
Is it?
Get off that trolley.
Really?
Get off that trolley and go make a bowl.
So you never saw their ad campaign?
No.
Rice-a-roni, the San Francisco treat.
Oh, no, I know. I've never seen
ding.
It. Sorry.
Okay, never mind then. That joke was lost on you.
Sorry.
Okay, Sarah, you have listened to our rice talk, but apparently you have something else on your mind. What did we screw? Did I screw something up?
No, it was all me.
Oh, okay,
or it was me and Brittany.
What?
I know. Well, that's what happens when you're talking Passover, because my family doesn't actually keep kosher. So when talking about being kosher, I should have done more research, and I said some information that wasn't quite correct.
Okay.
Ah. So a couple of things. For Passover, keeping kosher for Passover in particular, you can't use oat flour or rice flour or anything like that. Mm. So Brittany's suggestion of an apple crisp using oat flour is a no-go.
Okay.
You can still make an apple crisp, just don't
use
flour.
That wouldn't taste quite so good. But
I heard no flour.
No flour.
No flour at all.
Okay. Of any type. And the other thing is just we were talking about keeping kosher in general. And as I said, my family doesn't actually keep kosher and they never have. So I was saying that you just can't use rice and or not rice. Sorry, we've been talking rice. You can't use milk and meat in the same dish. Apparently, you can't use them in the same meal, period.
Yeah.
So and that goes for like desserts versus.
I think I challenged that last week. Yes.
Yeah, that's what happens when
no
I'm
dairy
just didn't
when
grow
you
up
eat
in
meat.
A kosher family. Yeah, no dairy when you eat meat at all.
No dairy in the kitchen when you work with meat. Actually,
yeah, no, you have to have a whole separate fridge,
right.
separate dishes, separate
right.
pans. Yeah, but sorry, that's, you know, I should have done more research.
Wow, you really messed up.
I know.
Yeah. Wow,
usually it's
excommunicado right there.
I know. I'm out of the tribe. Sorry, guys.
I love this show. What a safe space to admit when we don't know things. Tom,
I know,
just really
I don't
not
have any letters to write this week.
You know what's bad is we didn't have any help to give you either. Even though I knew that because I've cooked at Hillel before.
All right, Sarah. Well, you are absolved of your sins. If that's something we can do kosherly or not.
You know what? Sure, I'll take it.
Sure, why not? Okay, you're listening to us on Cairo Radio. Up next, it's Food for Thought, Tasty Trivia. Welcome back. It's time for Food for Thought, Tasty Trivia right here on Cairo Radio. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
And I am Katie O.
And Sarah is going to join us and administer our quiz today.
That is correct. Yeah, we are, of course, playing our Tasty Trivia Challenge, where you will each be asked 5 questions, and whoever gets the least amount correct has to give something up. And today, the person we're giving something up to is Mandy DeField, who asked us about whether or not she should buy a smoking gun. So, should you lose, Tom, what are you going to give to Mandy?
You know, we do lots of classes here at the Hot Stove Society, so I'll give her a class for 2 people, which is our regular classes. And at one of those classes, we'll figure out which one it is and let her know when we're doing a smoking class with home smoker things, which I think will be fun because we have a smoking gun here at the Hot Stove and we use it once in a while. But so we'll do 2 tickets to a future smoking class. That's a $170 value.
I'm going to give Mandy a brunch for 2 at Luke because I think that would be a good place to go. She can start with a smoked salmon scramble or something like that. We definitely have smoked salmon on the menu, so she can try that.
No smoke screen there.
Nope.
Katie, what are you giving away?
Well, I have access to ice. Some other delicious flavors right now, but no smoked ice cream. How about ice cream for her and 3 buddies at Molly Moon's Homemade Ice Cream?
That sounds delicious. All right. Well, who wants to get started on this trivia challenge?
Oh, I'll start.
All right, Terry. Your first question. State fairs are known for their outrageous deep-fried foods. If you're at a Wisconsin state fair and order the Fat Elvis, are you going to get a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup dipped in banana batter, deep-fried, and served on a stick? Or a deep-fried sandwich filled with peanut butter, grape jelly, and a pound of bacon?
I'm going to go with the sandwich.
It's actually the deep-fried Reese's Peanut Butter Cup.
Yeah, I had a feeling that would be something like that.
Yeah.
Both of them sounds very outrageous.
Yeah, both don't sound great for day-to-day diet. All right, your second question. What popular U.S. condiment was sold in discarded cologne bottles when it was first being sold in 1868? Is it Tabasco sauce, Worcestershire sauce, or Heinz ketchup?
Well, I would say Worcestershire is British. You said American, right?
Yes, I did. It's a U.S. condiment.
So I would go with ketchup.
It's actually Tabasco sauce.
Well, yeah, because ketchup is actually Chinese, right? Didn't we get that another way once? The ketchup was Chinese?
It could be the case. Well, no. Tomatoes are a new world food.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
All right, your third question, Terry. You can still bring it back. For best quality, how soon after purchase does the U.S. Department of Agriculture recommend using eggs? 1 week, 3 to 5 weeks, or 2 to 3 months?
I'm going to go with number 2, 3 to 5 weeks.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's the most logical one.
Yeah. They say that though the sell-by date will probably expire during that time, the eggs will still be safe to use. All right. You got 1 correct, Terry. Let's see if you can keep it going. Pumpkin pie is a popular Thanksgiving dessert. Where do most pumpkins grow in the U.S.? Ohio, Illinois, or Wisconsin?
I would say Ohio.
It's actually Illinois.
Oh, I should have said that too, huh? My deduction was right, though.
You were doing a good job.
If you grow corn and pumpkin in the same state, you'd probably be taken over the state.
There'd be no place left for
people. Illinois grows a lot of corn.
Yes, but Ohio is the corn state.
I would just ask, where's the Libby plant? Because they do the most pumpkin of anybody.
Yeah, that's fair.
True.
All right, your final question, Terry. You've got 1 correct so far.
She's really rubbing it in. Jeez.
I'm rocking it today.
All right. How long will food stored constantly at 0 degrees Fahrenheit remain safe to eat? 1 to 2 years, 5 years, or indefinitely?
Safe to eat.
Yes.
Is the question.
Doesn't mean you want to eat it.
His eyes are closed.
So I would say indefinitely.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, the quality will decrease the longer it's in the freezer.
No kidding.
But, all right, Terry, you got 2 out of 5.
Wow, this is very small shiny here.
Hey, it's more than one.
Smell what? Smell shiny?
Yeah, I'm not shining very high.
Okay.
Little dim. All right, Katie, you ready to go?
No, these questions sound hard today, but go ahead.
Okay, your first question. Kansas City-style barbecue sauce is always A, sweet and tomato-based, or B, tangy and vinegar-based?
Kansas.
Oh, you know the answer.
Sweet. It's sweet.
Is that your final answer?
Yeah, it is sweet.
You got it. All right. Your second question. When did Alice Waters' restaurant Chez Panisse open, pioneering the concept of local seasonal California cuisine? Is it 1985, 1971, or 2004?
I'm going to say it was in the 70s.
Yeah, you're correct. It was 1971.
Mm.
Yeah. It's been a while. All right. Since only the inside of melon, such as watermelon, is eaten, does the outer rind need to be washed?
Are you asking me personally what's going on here in my kitchen when I'm cutting? Well, I think they want you to wash it because your knife goes through the rind and there could be salmonella on the exterior that would cut into the flesh that you're going to eat.
Yes, perfect. That is correct.
But if you're coming to my house, I'm not really washing watermelons before.
If you're going
to
my mom's house, you're eating the rind.
And it's also grown on the ground, contact with dirt.
Mm. Yeah.
That's why you want to wash it.
Just a lot of dirt everywhere. All right. Burgoo is a spicy meat stew in Kentucky, often served with cornbread or corn muffins. Its alternate name is Wabash stew, Booyah, or roadkill soup.
I hope it's roadkill soup.
Yeah, it is roadkill soup.
Delish.
Very cool.
Yeah. For all you don't like these
Four
questions.
Points.
Yeah, you're doing real
you
well.
You know, like, just have some burgoo and a corn muffin. That'll really fix that dish.
Yep. All right, your final question. What temperature should ground meat be cooked to for it to be safe to eat? 165 degrees, 150, 200, or 140? And these are all Fahrenheit.
165.
Yes, that is correct. You got 5 out of 5. Katie.
Whoa! Nice job, Katie O. Yeah,
boom!
Nice job, just nice. Like that.
Impressive. All right, losers. Tom, it's your turn.
You ready?
Oh, man, she's been ruthless.
All right, Tom, your first question. When and where was the lobster roll invented?
Maine in 1822.
Do you want your options?
Yes.
All right. Cape Cod, Massachusetts, 1921. Maine, 1890. Or Connecticut, 1929.
Cape Cod.
No, it's Connecticut. It's in Milford, and the traditional Connecticut lobster roll is served hot, unlike the one we tend to eat today. Which popular brand of chip was invented at Disneyland? Fritos, Doritos, or Lay's?
Fritos.
Doritos.
Wow, delicious.
Yeah.
Who knew?
In 1964, unused Dorito or tortillas were cut up and fried with seasoning added at Casa de Fritos, a restaurant. All right. How long should you store leftovers in the refrigerator? 3 to 4 days, 1 to 2 weeks?
Moldy.
3 weeks.
So you can throw them away?
That's fair.
What did you say? 2 days?
3 to 4 days, 1 to 2 weeks, or 3 weeks?
3 to 4 days max.
Yeah, that's it. You got it. Who's a real person? Duncan Hines or Betty Crocker?
I'll say Duncan is the real person.
Yeah, you got it. He was born in Kentucky in 1880.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a traveling salesman, and he turned into a restaurant critic. That's how you get turned into food, I guess.
Yeah.
All right, what and when was the first cookbook published in America? Was it American Cookery in 1796, Family Recipes in 1786, or Freedom Food in 1800?
I will go with option one.
Yes.
Yeah, that's correct. American Cookery in 1796. Before that, it was all British cookbooks.
Ah.
All right. Well,
looks like I lost.
Terry, you're the loser,
yep.
Regardless of if Tom got that one question right. So congratulations to Mandy for getting Brunch for Two at Luke.
Yeah.
There you go. If you want to be part of the show like Mandy, either write us on our Facebook page or Twitter or come down and be part of the show. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Show is produced by Large Media. That's LARJ Media. Our lead producer is Sarah Leibovitz. And our sound engineer is Sean Don't Call Me Del Torre. If you would like to be part of our studio audience, go to HotStoveSociety.com and buy tickets for only $15. Remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.